Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henward, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest today, Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, just out in paper from Nation Books. The book is a study of the political economy of climate change, its effects on the already hot, poor, and chaotic parts of the world on either side of the equator. No time for a full news analysis today, but I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. As I said many times, this economic recovery that's been underway since June 2009 has felt little different from recession for many of us. Here are some reasons for that. According to the excellent folks at Sentier Research, staffed by alums of the Census Bureau, average household incomes declined by almost 3% during the formal recession. But they're down almost 5% in the recovery. A major reason for this long decline is that nearly 5% of workers suffered a permanent job loss between 2007 and 2011. Almost twice the share that took that sort of hit in the 1990s and early 2000s. Of those who lost jobs, only about half found new employment, about 20 percentage points below the share that did in the earlier years. And of those that found reemployment, less than 30% found higher paying work than the job they lost, compared with over 35% in the earlier years. Also, according to the National Employment Law Project, 60% of the jobs lost in the recession were in the middle pay tiers, but just 22%, a third as much, of those gained in the recovery were in that category. And well over half the new jobs have been the lowest paid occupations. So, huge job loss, weak recovery, and a recovery skewed towards low wage work means that average household incomes today are 8% below where they were in 2000. That is well over $4,000 below where they were more than a decade ago. My guest today is Christian Parenti. Christian is the author of several books, including the classic Lockdown America, the story of our carceral state, published in 2000 by Verso. I suppose I should disclose, in the interest of disclosure, that he's also a very good friend of mine, but that doesn't take away from his excellence as a writer and thinker. Tropic of Chaos is Christian's name for the area of the globe around the equator, between the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer, where much of both European colonialism and the Cold War were played out, and where climate change is having the most severe impact today. The region contains some of the poorest parts of the world, and those that are the most dependent on the vagaries of the weather. If a crop fails, you aren't merely forced to pay more for food, you're far more likely to die either of starvation or in a resource war. First, we'll hear an excerpt of an interview I did with Christian when the book first came out in hardcover last July, laying out some of the background. After that, we'll hear a fresh interview on developments over the last year or so that will fill out the rest of the show. If you'd like to hear the full earlier interview, you can find it in my archive at leftbusinessobserver.com, or just Google Doug Henwood Behind the News, and it'll just show up right on top of the list. Okay, here's Christian Parenti from July of last year. Welcome, Christian. I guess there have been a lot of books about climate change. How's yours different from the pack?
Well, I try to break the discussion of climate change out of the environmental and climate ghetto and connect it to issues of international development, war, and political economy in ways that other books haven't. It's based on several years of travel and reporting from failed and semi-failed states and war zones and struggling places around the world, and also based on a lot of historical research and political economic thought. And I try to tie all this together and continually bring out the climatological aspect in the history and current iteration of the crisis that one sees all across the global south, which expresses itself or appears as civil war, ethnic pogroms, religious violence, banditry, mass migration, general chaos and violence.
What is this Tropic of Chaos of the title?
Well, it's a reference to this belt of states. I became interested in failed states from reporting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the whole concept of failed states is something that the left at first, as I recall, sort of saw as a kind of right-wing notion.
Well, it's a staple of bourgeois discourse.
Yeah. And it's a staple of a particular type of kind of muscular, interventionist, crypto-racist bourgeois discourse, Kaplan being the best example of that. But, you know, there are actual failed states. And
What's the definition?
You know, I don't know if there's a strict definition, but my definition would be that a failed state is where the government is totally hollowed out and cannot do any of the things that governments do. Never mind whether it's things that you like or don't like, but like cannot collect taxes, cannot pave any roads. You know, you have the police, say in Congo. You have the police around. They won't let you take photographs in Kinshasa. And if the cops see you taking a photograph, they will arrest you and tell you that there's a huge fine and there's this law.
Just like a tourist kind of photo.
Yeah. Any kind of photo. I mean, I went through this. I took a photograph of this giant modernist space needle that looms over the slums. And, you know, there was a... But of course, there's no... I mean, really what it was just they wanted a bribe. And so there's, like, the appearance of a police state, but there are no dossiers, there's no accountability, but there are people...
They don't have the infrastructure to keep that kind of intelligence.
Right. I became interested in this whole category of failed states, and there was no left analysis of it. And what I try to do is give it a historical, political, economic look, you know, and explain that places like Somalia or Guinea-Bissau or Congo or Afghanistan, they didn't just emerge as failed states, and that one can push back against this crypto-racist subtext and really explain how imperialism basically produced failed states. You know, it produced these states. It went in many cases, not all, but in many cases, it went in and destroyed or significantly transformed the pre-existing societies, created states. The populations of those states, those colonies, fought back within the context that had been imposed upon them of these borders and laws. And you have the whole national independence movement and the wars of national liberation. But then empire continues to exploit and undermine the states of the global south after World War One, and after World War Two. And it's like that history of proxy wars of World Bank and IMF imposed liberalization of economies, that is what produces state failure. So there is, I think, a left history of state failure.
Yep, you say that a lot of books about climate change are about the future, and yours is mostly a book of history. And two important forces you identify in producing this climate crisis in failed states, or climate is exacerbating these situations in failed states, but two forces being the Cold War and neoliberalism. So let's talk about the contribution of each of those. Cold War first. What's the heritage of that?
The effect of the Cold War was to litter the global south with light weaponry and groups of men trained in the arts of smuggling, assassination, interrogation.
And the Cold War often fomented ethnic division, didn't it?
Yeah. The U.S. In particular used ethnic minorities to in its counterinsurgency. I mean, a crucial component of counterinsurgency is building auxiliary forces, building locals. And so frequently the U.S. would use ethnic minorities as their local adjuncts. And then those forces never remain completely dependent on and beholden to their masters, and they become independent violent actors and help really destroy societies and become a real problem for even those who formed them to begin with. Basically, what the Cold War overall does is that at the end of the Cold War, the Global South is full of groups of men who know how to fight, and they have guns, and they have training, and they've got these smuggling networks that they used to cross borders when they were mercenaries or when they were guerrillas or whatever. And the ideology and the larger, more noble motives are gone, and the methodology and the practices of war remain. And then the other element is liberalization. So the World Bank and IMF have been demanding that indebted countries of the Global South privatize state assets, cut support to small farmers and fishermen, cut spending on health care and education, and open their economies. And this has created increased inequality, increased poverty, in some situations increased rates of growth, but the wealth from that is unequally distributed, but in some cases it's created real stagnation. So these two forces of the Cold War, with its like use of proxy forces and seeding the Global South with weaponry and training, and then neoliberal structural adjustment creating these very unequal, impoverished societies with lots of tension and anomie, where people are not connected to their old communities, have been thrown out of their jobs or thrown off the land. This is the stage onto which climate change now arrives with its extreme weather, its floods, its droughts. And so you can't really look at climate change outside of the context of that history. So like take a place like Afghanistan. Climate change is not the cause of the war, but one thing climate change is doing in Afghanistan has been the worst drought in living memory. And that's kind of where I started thinking about writing this book, was in Afghanistan, interviewing poppy farmers who kept mentioning the drought. And one thing that happened was the drought didn't stop. The drought went on and on and on for now about a decade. And they explained that this was really important why they grew poppy. And at first I didn't really hear it. It was in my notes, and I'd even put it in my articles. And later I realized that, wait, that's quite significant. You know, and I looked into it more, and it turns out that poppy uses 1/5 the amount of water of wheat. And it's similarly advantaged compared to other traditional Afghan crops like apricots and raisins and stuff like that. So the NATO occupation and the Afghan government attack poppy, at least in rhetoric and sometimes actually with eradication. The Taliban defend the farmers' right to grow poppy. So there's an element in why young men in the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan in the south join the Taliban, support the Taliban. Some of it has to do with their xenophobia and hostility towards Tajiks and certainly towards Americans and French and Dutch who are coming around. And some of it has to do with their religious beliefs and the grand stories that the Taliban organizers tell them. But some of it has to do with very basic material stuff. They can survive maybe if they grow poppy. The government and its foreign allies are not letting them do that. And the Taliban are saying, you know, we will protect you. We will drive these people who are threatening your livelihood out of this valley if you help us. So that's a very clear climatological aspect to why the war drags on, how the war is actually lived by the people on the ground.
Now, you also look at resource wars, and this nasty, hotter world. People are fighting over the real basics, like water and food, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the most direct examples of how climate change causes violence are local resource wars. So, like, in Kenya, pastoralists are shooting each other with guns that flow out of Somalia, the failed state.
You open the book with a guy whose head's been ripped open by a bullet, right? How'd he end up dead?
His name was Ekru Lorman, and he's a Turkana pastoralist, and he had been shot by the Pokot who came to raid his cattle. Cattle raiding is a traditional activity in the Horn of Africa, but it's become more intense and more violent. One, because there's all this light weaponry from the Cold War, and two, because all of the old supports that the state once had, livestock improvement programs, well drilling programs, all that stuff has been pulled back because of economic liberalization. So the pastoralists are really left to their own devices. And now what's hitting them? An almost decade-long drought, which has been punctuated occasionally by really, really extreme and sudden floods. So this is the context in which people like Ekru Larman find themselves, and they fall back on their own devices, which in many cases are AK-47s. So his people were grazing their herds, and the Pokot came down from these mountains, who were their traditional enemies, and tried to steal these cattle, and about 6 people were killed in this raid, and he was one of them. And that's going on all the time in northern Kenya. And there's also a lot of ambushes on the roads. People are not just raiding each other's cattle, they're raiding buses and shooting passengers. All the buses have armed guards on them. The police go in with helicopters. The police look like soldiers. You see them at checkpoints. They're like in camo and carrying machine guns, and they go after these raiding parties. And then the raiding parties are sometimes connected to organized crime in Kampala and Nairobi, who will buy the cattle.
Well, they could put the cops in camouflage, but the state is really kind of weak and powerless, right?
Yeah. I mean, the state has no other programs other than this repressive response. And the repressive response by the Kenyan police is pretty minimal. I mean, they're just sort of like desperately trying to keep a lid on things. It's not...
They don't have the budget or the organization, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, part of an interview first broadcast in this show in July 2011. You can find the full interview in my archive at leftbusinessobserver.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. We'll be back with a fresh interview after this musical break. of some of Arnold Schoenberg's suite for piano, Opus 25, the second movement, performed by Maurizio Pollini. And now on to my fresh interview with Christian Parenti, done just the other day, covering more recent materials on the science and politics of climate change. Christian's book, Tropic of Chaos, is just out in paper from Nation Books. Christian Parenti. So we've had some pretty odd weather in the last few weeks. Should we make anything of it, Christian, or is this just random points on a random graph?
Well, James Hansen, the country's top climatologist, published a paper with some other people that argues that extreme weather is increasingly common, and that you can say to some extent that the increased extreme weather we see is caused by climate change. You know, but it's still, you can't really say that any one storm is caused by it. But what we're seeing is that the incidence of flooding, drought, hurricanes, freak snowstorms are increasing.
It just seems like an increasing frequency of extreme and, you know, once-in-a-lifetime events happening.
Yeah, yeah.
More often than once in a lifetime.
Yeah. 2010 was a very bad year for wheat crops. That led to the food price spikes of June 2010 to 2011, which was, you know, part of what triggered the Arab Spring, which is that name kind of implies that everything that came from that was good. But actually, you know, grain prices from June 2010 to June 2011, corn and wheat, basically almost doubled. And that's due to really bad drought in the Black Sea region, called the Black Sea Drought, which caused Russia to cancel its wheat export orders. The single largest wheat importer in the world is Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, the rest of the Maghreb, also very heavily dependent on imported grains, both corn and wheat. Wheat for people eating corn, mostly for animal feed. And corn prices had gone up. Wheat went up something like 83%. Corn had gone up like 91%. The corn had gone up mostly due to flooding. But now this year we have, again, you know, this really bad drought in the Midwest. Already corn prices have gone up 25%. And it's dry in a lot of the wheat-producing regions in the former USSR, so in Kazakhstan, Russia, and Ukraine. And, you know, the reverberations of all of this politically will be felt down the line, and it won't look like, oh, this is climate change causing violence. It'll look like people rioting about some specific political grievance with some specific kleptocratic leader, or communities, religious communities turning on each other, as they are in northern Nigeria and across the, you know, the Sahel in Africa, where there's sort of a Muslim-Christian cultural boundary of sorts intermingling right at the same place that there is the sort of semi-arid region that butts up against a really, you know, properly arid region. And that region is increasingly stressed ecologically, I think, due to climate change. I mean, again, it's very hard to prove any of these specific things. But, you know, the pattern of disrupted weather patterns, increased heat, increased drought, increased flash flooding, all that stuff is playing out. And so all across this region, you get increased Christian-Muslim tensions. So that's what's going on in northern Nigeria. You also see this in Burkina Faso, and, you know, a little bit in Cote d'Ivoire, where Muslims from Burkina Faso and Mali have moved down into Ivory Coast. And, you know, so there's this ethnic, religious tension. But, you know, it's not reducible to climate change, but it has some degree of causality is rooted in the fact that food prices are going up and that people's livelihoods are threatened by the increasingly unstable climate. And in societies, economies that aren't industrialized, where people live close to the land and are dependent on the natural systems, the margin of error economically is very, very thin. And
yeah, I was going to say that if for people in rich countries like the United States or Western Europe, the rise in food prices is unpleasant, but it is not, for now at least, a crisis. But in parts of the world, it is. So we're seeing what real differential effects of that, depending upon where you are and where you rank on the income ladder, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, it hits consumers more than producers. So you don't see the crisis in the wheat growing region. You see it in the wheat consuming region. I mean, incomes might be down and farmers might suffer under a drought in the Midwest or in Kazakhstan or Russia, but they don't suffer as much as people who are really dependent on imported food and suddenly see their food bills surge up. I mean, I think I've said this stuff on your show before, but, you know, I mean, just in terms of getting the Arab Spring thing, it's like in Egypt, the average family spends 40% of their income on food. And in 2010, 2011, food inflation was running at more than 20% a year. When I did my research on it, I found that number. Then later, The Economist did a piece, and they said it was like 30-something percent. I think it was 38% a year. I mean, that's a lot. So we're back in a situation like that. I mean, that's what's going to be playing out over the next year. The drought in the Midwest has hammered corn, and also we can expect problems with wheat, and this is going to play out all over the world. But then the other thing, of course, is like these really bad policies that exacerbate the environmental crisis. So half of our corn crop goes to ethanol, because 10% of our gasoline is corn. And, you know, I mean, that is just...
That's bonkers. Using corn for fuel is totally bonkers, right?
It's totally bonkers. It's basically, all it is the battery for storing energy that in large part comes from oil, right? You have nitrogen fertilizer produced from petrochemicals, and you have tractors running on diesel and gasoline, and you produce corn with this, and then you use more energy to turn that corn into high-grade alcohol and add it to gasoline and then burn it and becomes energy. I mean, it's just a battery. It's a complicated storage mechanism. There really isn't any reduction in CO2 emissions from biofuels. And if anything, there's an increase from corn ethanol, also from palm oil, because a lot of Europe sources its biodiesel from Indonesian palm oil, and that involves clearing rainforests, dredging peat bogs. The dredging of the peat bogs releases massive amounts of methane. The clearing of the forests involves direct emissions of CO2, and they're burnt. So in the end, a lot of biofuel has a larger CO2 footprint than just regular gasoline.
In the U.S., we use ethanol because agribusiness likes it and because it's good for the farm vote, right? Mm-hmm. Is there any other reason to do it other than those
I don't think so.
Rather poor reasons.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's just like, it's, you know, you look at these states, they're swing states, so everyone is struggling over Iowa, Indiana, Missouri, and this is a great welfare program for, you know, farmers and agribusiness, and so the political class in this country has zero incentive to move away from it.
Now, the Financial Times did a piece a few weeks ago about the drought in the Midwest. They quote some farmer who said something like, you know, well, I don't know. I don't think it's humans doing this. It's God, you know. And as the FT's reporter added, as he harvested a crop that was a third its normal size. The politics of this, it seems like people are unable to connect point A and point B. I mean, has there been any progress in making the connection between point A and point B?
You know, I don't know. I don't. You read the public opinion polls more than I do, but my impression is that there hasn't been much. But this is very anecdotal. I have a student who's an Indiana farmer, and he was out there for the summer. And he, you know, his family are religious fundamentalists. He said everybody, and they were just being hammered by the drought. He went out there. He's a graduate student, and he went out there to work on the farm, earn some money for the summer. And there was no work because they're short 17 inches of rain. So he was doing other stuff, non-farm labor. And he said that pretty much everyone was in denial that there was such a thing as man-made climate change, anthropogenic climate change. So I don't see any sign that experience is changing people's minds. You know, as we all know, you know, I mean, experience doesn't necessarily speak for itself. People bring frameworks of interpretation to even the most extreme and wrenching experiences.
It's really wrong to speak of the climate crisis in the future tense anymore, right? It's here.
Yes, it is here. One of the really bad parts of it, too, is the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 100 years ago. And this is because they're absorbing CO2, and CO2 makes the oceans acidic. This affects the creation of shells on shellfish, such as oysters or mussels. But more importantly, the tiny shellfish that are the basis of the marine food chain, this is affecting their ability to create shells. So this is like directly damaging the very basis of the entire marine food system. I mean, that's a profound crisis that we hear very little about and we don't experience because we're on land and the ocean remains an abstraction to it. But yeah, so the climate crisis is underway, and the climate crisis, you know, is also always political. It intersects, from what I argue in Tropical Chaos, is that it always intersects with these pre-existing problems, specifically of militarism and neoliberal economic restructuring. And that exacerbates the problem tremendously. And you see that here in the U.S. around the issue of the public sector. The Republicans are going after the public sector in the form of public schools and state budgets everywhere. And this is, you know, the worst thing that we could be doing in the face of the climate crisis. So in Vermont last year, we were hit by the remnants of Hurricane Irene, which dumped enormous amounts of water on the state and flooded out a lot of towns. And it was an example of government, the response was actually an example of government working well and communities coming together and working with government and government supporting communities and supporting people and their voluntary efforts. But the direction of the mainstream of politics in this country and in many ways internationally is to undermine those very institutions, you know, to defund and privatize state infrastructure. And one thing that's really clear during natural disasters is that the state government is the institution that comes to the fore. To the extent that we as a society can cope with disaster generally has to do with the health and ability and robustness of government institutions to respond. It's an emergency and the state steps in. I mean, this is like a kind of Carl Schmitt right-wing kind of definition of the state. The sovereign is the institution that can define and operate in an emergency. But, you know, there's a progressive read on that, which said that's, you know, that's what climate change is kind of calling forward right now, is that we really grapple with what is the state and, you know, what can it do? I mean, obviously it has tons of problems. I mean, I've written 4 books basically critiquing the state as an entity, critiquing the American state, critiquing violence, surveillance, policing, war, all that. But, of course, government is more than just the repressive functions of the state. And in this moment that we're in and entering, I think we really need to start talking about the other aspects of government, that it is the set of institutions that can ensure the common good and can, in a moment of disaster, kind of in reverse of disaster capitalism. I mean, Naomi Klein is right that capitalists use disaster to redistribute wealth upward. But if there is a functioning and accountable state structure, so too can disasters be a moment when, in the name of the collective good and emergency, wealth is redistributed down and people in need are taken care of. So that's what actually what you saw in Vermont to some extent.
So you've been traveling around the world since the book has come out. You're doing a lot of traveling for your job. Do you find that kind of response, the Vermont response, visible in other places?
No, I mean, it has to do with state capacity. I mean, most states in the global south generally don't have the money and resources to respond as robustly as a place like Vermont. But the same questions are in play. And in Vietnam, there's a debate underway about what the response should be by the state and whether it should be. There's a kind of struggle within the government. There's like as some people I was talking to refer to it as a concrete mafia. The sort of building interests in Vietnam have embraced climate change, and they just want to build dikes all along the coast of the Mekong Delta, which would be a disaster. But this is, you know, endless work for them for like, you know, 60 years. And then there's other branches of government that are listening to scientists who are saying we have to basically retreat 1 kilometer in, stop allowing people to settle on the coasts, you know, withdraw subsidies and support, and just slowly, just basically recreate a buffer of at least 1 kilometer to block rising sea levels and break storm surges. And, you know, Vietnam, which was one of the countries I went to this year, is one of the 5 most vulnerable countries in terms of climate change. And that has to do primarily with the fact that the heart of its economy is still the Mekong Delta. 30 million people live in the Mekong Delta. Saigon and Ho Chi Minh City is actually on the edge of the Mekong Delta. But that's where most of the fish and most of the rice that Vietnam produces comes from. And Vietnam is still very dependent on agriculture and fishing and timber and mining for its economic growth. So it has been, along with Thailand, India, Vietnam, they're basically, you know, they switch around as to who's the number one rice exporter. And for a number of years in the last decade, Vietnam was the world's number one rice exporter. And that all of that rice, pretty much like 90-something percent of it, came out of the Mekong Delta. The whole Mekong Delta is like at about 1 meter above sea level. The best case scenarios that all scientists agree on, that the World Bank, UN, all agree on, is that we're locked in for, by the end of this century, a 1 meter sea rise, more or less. That's the best case scenario. So the Mekong Delta, the heart of the Vietnamese economy, is in the crosshairs of climate change. And they are beginning to try and plan for this. And there's a debate about that. And government is at the center of that. But that's not necessarily a good thing. It could be like government subsidizing the cement mafia to just pour cement everywhere, or it can be like actual planning.
Yeah, well, it seems like we're not doing much to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, so the alternative is going to be to build lots of giant walls.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, we're not doing much to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As I've said before, the key thing to remember is, and this is what I say at the end of the book, is that, you know, we have, in this country, which is the heart of the problem, we have everything we need to move forward. We don't need new legislation. We have enabling legislation. It's the Clean Air Act. There was this famous lawsuit, Massachusetts versus EPA, in which states and green groups sued to get greenhouse gases considered dangerous under the Clean Air Act. That was made law in 2007. The Supreme Court said, yes, CO2 and the other major greenhouse gases are dangerous to human health, therefore they must be regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Clean Air Act. And we've been waiting ever since then for the EPA to issue these rules. So the tragedy of the early Obama years was that farce of trying to come up with comprehensive climate legislation. We don't need that. We have it. The EPA can issue rules that essentially impose a carbon tax on polluters. It says, okay, you're free to burn filthy coal, but you will have to pay these fines, which would make it uneconomical to do that.
That's a bad command and control approach, right?
Right.
Not a nice market cap and trade approach, right? Was that the political problem for the Obama's perspective?
That's precisely the political problem. And it's, you know, it's clear that he has told the EPA to go slow because they have been dragging their feet on issuing these rules. Okay, so we've got one ingredient of what we need to address this, which is like we have the laws. We also have the technology. It's not like we haven't yet invented efficient, you know, wind power systems, solar power, et cetera, et cetera. All that technology exists. It just has to be scaled up. Well, how do you do that? You need laws and you need money. We also have tons of money. The government, the U.S. government, has enormous amounts of money currently going into wasteful things such as the military budget, but also going into its everyday operations, which could be used to jumpstart a switch away from fossil fuels. So the federal government is the largest single consumer of energy in this country. It has the largest single fleet of buildings, like 450,000 major office buildings. If they committed themselves to buying clean energy for those buildings, retrofitting those buildings, et cetera, this would have knock-on effects throughout the economy and would help create a market for those types of services and those products like clean energy and building retrofitting. And then,
I'll just go to that point. They wouldn't have to spend more money. They just spend it differently.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they
which
are
would
going
catalyze a whole different way of approaching things.
Right. Yeah.
And they're not doing it.
They're not doing it for fear of alienating swing voters and swing states, I guess. And then the other thing, you know, the private sector is also flush with cash, not just bonuses and profits, but, you know, corporate America is sitting on almost $2 trillion of uninvested money. And they're waiting for cues. You know, what do? We're going to, like, buy a new fleet of trucks. Will they be diesel? Will they be electric? They're waiting for cues on this stuff. What do we invest in? Do we invest in gas-fired power plants or solar plants? So there's plenty of government money. There's plenty of private money. There is the technology, and there's actually the laws already in place. So that's the tragedy of the Obama era, is that all the pieces have been in place from the beginning, and nothing has been done.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books.
Well, are there vested interests of the large capitalist sort that are inhibiting this, or is it crude electoral politics, fear of being, you know, green baited by Republicans? What's going on?
I think it's the vested interests are the most important part, that the fossil fuel industry has pushed back with, you know, really aggressive messaging. Tens of millions of dollars invested by ExxonMobil and the Western Fuels Federation and the Koch brothers. You know, they have invested a lot of money in promulgating the myth that climate change isn't real, or that if it is real, it's not man-made, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the primary thing. And then what flows from that is Democrats being afraid that they're going to be called tree huggers, et cetera, et cetera. So then they back away from any kind of policy initiatives or, you know, allowing the EPA to do its job.
Now, some of our more radical comrades would say that we really can't do anything. And the point you just made underscores this. We can't do anything about this to overthrow capitalism. There's no way that capitalism can coexist with sustainable economic models. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think that capitalism, you know, a kind of radical free market capitalism based on just rampant consumerism can't last forever. No. I mean, I think that's true. That's an impossibility. But I am I do not think that we can wait for the overthrow or even the significant transformation and reform of capitalism before dealing with the climate problem. And what I argue in the end of the book is that we have to see the climate problem as a subset of the overall environmental problem, that it's not the same as solving all environmental problems. It can seem as if it is because the consequences of not dealing with the climate crisis are cataclysmic and apocalyptic. So therefore, it can be easily confused with all other problems because it can eclipse them. But it's actually a much more discrete, specific problem, which has to do with greenhouse gas emissions and how we produce energy. And I think, and the timeline that the science, which is not in debate, has been pretty clear on, is that, you know, we have to deal with this starting immediately and deal with it in a meaningful way over the next 2-3 decades. And I don't think it's realistic to think that we can transform global capitalism in that time frame and then deal with the world society's addiction to fossil fuels. So in other words, what I argue at the end of the book is that capitalism has to get off of fossil fuels if we're going to avoid climate tipping points. That's not the same as saying capitalism can be made sustainable, capitalism can reconcile itself with the earth. That's not the same thing. It's just taking the science, the climate science, which says that there are tipping points and that we are at them or arriving to them, and that the time frame for shifting off of fossil fuels is so compressed that if you're to be realistic about it, it means that this society, these institutions, these governments, these businesses have to make that change, or we're just going to blow right through these red lines. And, you know, in many ways, we have, and we're locked in for very dramatic climate change. And so another aspect of what we need to be thinking about, talking about, and planning for is adaptation, not just mitigation. What I was talking about is mitigation, mitigating the causes, but I mean, adapting to a new, more extreme climate is something that has to be at the heart of politics, because we're locked in, for better or for worse, we're locked in to serious changes. And that means we're gonna need to reorganize how we produce food, how we move things, you know, how we live.
Are there other capitalist economies, not that there are many other kinds these days, but are there other ones that are doing a better job of it than we are?
I mean, certainly, you know, in Scandinavia, they're doing, and Germany. I mean, Germany has invested a lot in renewable energy. It has a feed-in tariff, which allows anyone who produces electricity to feed it into the grid and get paid by the utilities. If we could do that here, that would be a tremendous step forward, you know, to say that anyone who can run their meter backwards will get paid for doing it. So if you put enough solar panels on the roof of your house, not only do you not pay the electrical bill, the electrical utility has to pay you the market rate for the energy you've produced. So there's those examples. And then, you know, I mean, the Chinese, with all their contradictions, I mean, they've invested heavily in renewable energy, and a lot of it comes out of the local crisis of air quality in Chinese cities.
You hear mixed things about China. On the one hand, they're, you know, opening coal-fired plants like crazy. They're the big and up-and-coming threat to the climate. On the other hand, you hear that they're doing lots of investing and research and deployment of advanced technologies. Are both these things true?
Yeah, I think both of them are true. They're opening fewer coal plants than they used to. That whole, like, one plant a week statistic, that's like 10 years old now. They're not opening that many plants. But yeah, they're doing both. And there's always a struggle between the central government and the provincial governments. But the Chinese have, you know, invested in all of this technology and have been successful to the point where the U.S. has now imposed a 31% tariff on the import of Chinese solar panels, which is, you know, I think bad in the long run, because
our complaint is they're subsidizing them,
which they are. So there's been two tariffs. So should we. We should subsidize it too. Yeah. So there was a 4 to 6% tariff placed on them because of the subsidies, and then there's this other tariff, which is sort of separate from that. And the effect of it seems to be that there has been a slowdown in investment in expanding production facilities in China. So, I mean, it's not good that the U.S. has put that tariff on Chinese solar panels. I know a lot of people who want to see a domestic clean tech sector supported. I spoke with some guy who worked for a German firm, so we're being destroyed by this Chinese competition. Without this tariff, like, we wouldn't be able to function. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of clean technology firms are facing really tough times. Some of that is Chinese competition. Some of that is the lack of creating markets here in the United States. The U.S. government isn't buying this technology. It isn't buying clean energy, so there aren't any markets. So these firms are like waiting for the markets to be created. And some of it is also the fact that natural gas, the Marcellus Shale, has just, you know, destroyed energy markets in many ways. We went from a 20-year supply of gas in this country to a 100-year supply, which brings us to the question of peak stuff, which we should maybe talk about. But so now we have just a glut of natural gas, and that has just destroyed energy prices because it's so cheap. So that's made it much harder to profitably build solar or wind facility and sell energy into the grid, because it's just cheaper to do it with natural gas.
Well, and since you brought it up, the U.S. is now, oil production is rising rapidly. The U.S. is projected to become, the second largest oil producer in the world by 2020, I believe. I saw one report that claimed this. I think there are a lot of people who drew some solace from the fact that we're allegedly running out of it, but it doesn't look like we really are, does it?
Yeah. No. I've always thought that the peak resource stuff was misplaced. And in many ways, it is a wish masquerading as a fear, or expressed as a fear. And the fact of the matter is, like, people like Richard Heinberg, the peakists, I mean, what they're describing is the world they would like to see, not the world they fear, you know. And we're not running out of oil. We're not running out of petroleum, as witnessed by the shale gas boom. And they're now using fracking technology in getting crude oil out. So, you know, I mean, who knows what could happen to recoverable reserves? This is one of the things in the peak oil argument. They talk about recoverable resources. Well, that's an economic.
That's a very flexible category.
Yeah. If the price goes high enough, then extreme oil is recoverable. Yes, there are risks, but those are externalities. Those are somebody else's problems. So you have a blowout. Your well blows out on the coast of Angola. Bummer to be an Angolan fisherman. But, like, in the meantime, Angola has found massive amounts of offshore oil. The Paraçal, the pre-salt offshore oil in Brazil, you know, huge amounts of oil. It's really, really far out and really, really far down. But if the price is high enough, they'll go get it. And then also, you know, so too with the depletion of certain types of resources, like copper, for example. People talk about how, you know, one third of copper, of all copper, remains in the ground, one third is in use, and one third is in the landfills. You know, they could very well go mine the landfills. That would be a toxic disaster in and of itself. But, you know, it's not as if the copper goes away. Capitalism could conceivably find ways to recycle, probably the worst possible way to recycle this spent copper. But the one thing where there really are limits is in the sinks. It's not the resources, it's the pollution, and it's the Earth's ability to absorb pollution. That is where there are real limits. And we see it in the ocean's acidification, and we see it in the atmosphere. And for that, there's no recycling, there's no, if the price gets high enough, you can find another sink. I mean, these are the real limits. So, I mean, I'm a pollution fundamentalist. I was talking with various environmentalists when this book came out, and sort of being accused of being a carbon fundamentalist because I wasn't connecting, I wasn't sort of situating climate change as just one among many problems. And I don't, because I think it is of an order of magnitude different. I mean, if climate change runs out of control, becomes self-fueling, if the permafrost melts and all there's this huge methane release, a greenhouse gas 20 times more powerful than CO2, if runaway climate change happens, then all the other environmental problems are also going to pale in comparison, because the very basis of civilization will be wiped out. So I do think climate change is an issue that trumps all others.
Well, we're just about out of time, but it just whenever I think about this sort of thing, I'm overtaken by near despair. So I tend to try not to think about it so much. I'm sure I'm not the only one person who feels that way. Can you offer some words of at least encouragement or some sense of an antidote to despair? or is that asking too much?
How to avoid despair? We don't know what the future will be. We can indicate certain directions of it. I mean, like, there could be political and technological changes that help pull us back from the brink. But there is another kind of philosophical despair that people have that I think is unwarranted. I mean, every individual faces the fact that they know they're going to die. That hasn't changed. It's just about, you know, taking your life seriously in the context of civilization's crisis and realizing that with the time one has on Earth, one has to find ways to try and preserve human civilization. That's in some ways that's always been the task that people face. Every society faces at times existential threats or imagines that it does. So there's ways in which, like, our situation isn't that new. I mean, imagine being a Russian when the Nazis are coming in 1941. I mean, it's the people have faced this question of the collapse of their worlds before at a kind of like ontological level. And so I think people should just suck it up and you know, confront the facts and be involved in politics and not succumb to that kind of despair, because it's bad odds, etc., etc. Not that unique historically. You know, a lot of people have faced similar odds and carry on and, you know, fight on and find ways out of it. So do we. That's what we have to do.
We beat the Black Plague.
Yeah.
That was Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, a study of climate change, state collapse, and violence, just out in paper from Nation Books. And since we ended on a note invoking recovery from the Black Plague, how about going out with this bit of musical uplift, an excerpt from Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Till next week, bye.